Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, returning, is Lisa Z. Siegel. She's a professor of history at DePaul University of Chicago, and we're continuing our conversation about her new book, The People's Porn, A History of Handmade Pornography in America. Lisa, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
This is such an unusual book. We had to do two interviews about it. And I'm sure a lot of people are asking, like, why look at these objects at all? What is the importance of looking at homemade porn?
Well, a lot of materials have been destroyed, pornographic materials. Much of the archive from the 19th century has just been entirely wiped out by Comstock and other social purity crusaders. So understanding the history of sexuality at all, we have to turn to whatever materials we have, including homemade porn.
Now, I want to, for people who don't know or maybe have never heard of, let's talk about Kinsey's research and what he did, because we're going to be talking about prison porn, and a lot of that information comes from his research. How did he collect objects and material?
Well, Kinsey started his book from his so-called marriage course, which he was at Indiana University in Bloomington, and he was responsible, since he was a biologist working on gall wasps, he was responsible for teaching.
It's a bit of a stretch, Lisa.
It is a bit of a stretch, but he seemed to be up for it.
Okay.
So he started teaching a course on marriage, and he was entirely dissatisfied with the materials that he found. So he started collecting materials from his students. He would do questionnaires and ask them about their sexual histories. And he began to develop this base of data, but he understood the limitations of his data, that it was largely white students, middle-class students. They were going to be college-educated students, and he wanted to go and try and expand his knowledge base. So one of the first things he did, he went to Boys Town in Chicago to try and talk to queer peoples, but he also wanted to get people outside of the Midwest. So he started going to wardens and asking if he could speak and work with prisoners. And the wardens were pretty happy to work with Kinsey.
I find that sort of hard to believe.
I believe he was really sincere about this. He began to develop an interest in sexual accommodation amongst prisoners.
Okay.
How prisoners deal with sexual deprivation. And he said he would help the wardens understand their inmates. And the wardens were like, yes, come in, talk to our inmates.
Now, that brings up the whole problem of sexuality in prisons to begin with. First of all, it's completely frowned upon. Sexual behavior in prisons, even today, is a hot topic. It's just one of those things that people don't want to deal with.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that people don't know and deeply don't care about is that prisoners are often not allowed to masturbate in prison. And it's sort of screamy, like, ooh, but people, this is where prisoners live. This is their only place of belonging at the moment of their incarceration. And so denying people the right to access to their own bodies seems just cruel to me.
Well, there have been people who have talked about it before, and you write about this in the book. Joseph F. Fishman, who brought the problem of sexuality in prisons to national attention, talk to me about what he did.
Well, he did a large-scale study in the 1930s, and he was interested in prisoner sexuality. There were lots of different kinds of prisons, and there was no uniform standard. And he wanted to go and allow prisoners some sort of access. Now, the model of what access, the best sort of access, would be marital accommodation, letting prisoners' wives come to visit.
Conjugal visits, as they call
it. Conjugal visits, yes. And he thought that that was the best model. One of the things that he did was just establish that there was not a lot of research being done or awareness about prisoner sexuality overall.
And he thought that this would actually help with violence and behavior in the prison overall, that it, once they had access to this, that they would sort of behave better.
Yes. And Kinsey thought that access to sex, Kinsey as well thought that sex was a basic biological need for human beings, and that prisons needed to understand that and learn how to work with the prisoner population so that prisoners could have access to this basic biology. Basically, they needed access to some sort of sexual outlet.
You write about this pretty passionately in the book, and you talk about prisoners having very limited civil rights, that they were, quote, civilly dead slaves without rights. And that just goes beyond the sexuality issues, too. It's just the way that we think about prisoners.
Yes, they have no fundamental innate rights to literature or to the press. And that goes both ways, as far as I understand it. There is no access for the press to have access to prisoners, or the prisoners to have access to materials like literature, magazines, newspapers, and this is still true.
Now, what kind of materials did Kinsey collect?
Kinsey collected everything he could get his hands on.
Are these collections still available to the researchers?
Yes, they're available to researchers at the Kinsey Institute in Bloomington, beautiful Bloomington, Indiana. It's a lovely, lovely archive, deeply underfunded. If anybody's rich out there, just shower your money down on the Kinsey Institute. He collected everything he could possibly get his hands on. He believed in collecting as wide a sample as possible. So things that other people wouldn't want, that they thought was just completely without value, he was like, I'll take it.
Wow.
And so things like newspapers with, you know, usually people will take a picture of a person and draw, like, eyeglasses. When people drew penises on them, Kinsey would collect it. If somebody would send it to him, he would collect it.
Did he file these? And, like, did he have a filing system?
He did have a filing system. His filing systems were, they have since been redone by the archivists.
Okay.
One of the things which I found out when I was doing my doctoral research and I was looking at photographs was his filing system was based on his biological research. So he used a protractor to decide whether people were standing or lying down, and he separated the images on that basis.
I'm sure he had some assistant doing that with the protractor. I'm sure it wasn't Kinsey himself. It was some poor benighted assistant that's sitting there with the protractor. Okay,
yes.
They're lying down.
Yeah, they're lying down. So, okay, put it in this pile.
Oh, my God.
He had filing systems. He collected everything. He collected photographs. He collected some of the wardens they seized. You know those little footballs that you would make when you were in grade school?
Yeah.
Yes. So prisoners would write letters to each other and flick them at each other like footballs. He collected those. Whatever the wardens would give them that they had seized from, like, shakedowns, he would collect if it had to do with sexuality.
You just mentioned something sort of in passing, but it's interesting. They were collected from shakedowns.
Some of them were collected from shakedowns. Some of them, he apparently worked, and it's not very clear. He apparently worked with some of the wardens and created, quote-unquote, hot rooms, where he gave supplies and prisoners created their own erotic art.
Now, this is only male prisoners. Did he ever deal with female prisoners?
He did not, or at least not as far as I know.
I find that really interesting.
Yes. Well, male prisoners were considered far more problematic when he was working in the 1940s and 1950s.
It's like unlike today.
Yeah.
Now, of all of Kinsey's materials, as you write, the prison collections have been largely ignored by researchers.
Yes, the prisoner collection has been largely ignored. I think nobody knows. So people who work on the history of prisons have a lot of work to do. They have, you know, enormous amounts of materials to try and work through. They're trying to make sense of what happened in prisons, how they developed over time. They have lots of things to do, and sexuality is really ancillary. On the other hand, historians of sexuality have lots of work to do, and what's happening with prisoners is really ancillary. So prison porn has really fallen through the cracks. No one is concerned with it, despite it being this amazing collection.
Well, let's talk about the collection and the examples that you have in your book. Because of all the things in your book, I found the prisoners section to be probably the most disturbing in some cases.
Yes.
Because it reflects the sort of violence and what happens when you lock a person up.
Yeah. I mean, some of the pamphlets or stories that people wrote are really violent. There's one set of two pamphlets which I found just fascinating and disturbing. In one case, it shows a guy spying on a woman and then going in and raping her. And then in the second case, it's exactly the same images, but it shows it as consensual sex, that he goes in and has sex and she's up for it. So using these two documents together, you can see that he could both understand consent and non-consent and visualize intercourse both ways.
What about sadism? Sadism seems to be big in a lot of it, too.
Yeah, sadism is big, although there are other collections which also are very sadistic. So it's not only in the prison porn that you have lots of sadism and rape and violence.
Well, let's talk about how they made this, because they have limited access to materials. What are these mostly made out of? They sort of pencil and paper comic books or what?
They're pencil and paper. There's crayons. There's pipe cleaner figures where you make like a little guy with a little penis and then you tie a string through the back of a little box, and you move the string, and the penis goes up and down. There's Peach Pit figures.
Whoa. Okay, talk about Peach Pit figures. Carved?
They're carved.
Okay.
They're carved.
I understand.
This is a folk art form of carved Peach Pits. And they have one at the Kinsey of a little monkey who is masturbating with one hand. And with the other, he's thumbing his nose at whoever's looking at him. So there's a little carved Peach Pit figure. There's sheets, you know, guys taking their sheets and making.
Right, the entire sheet.
The entire sheet.
Yeah.
Beautiful object of a woman, you know, with hair and breasts and, yes, beautiful sheet.
What I found interesting in your book is that obviously the prisoners knew of the scientific study of their materials and actually drew cartoons about that.
Yes. They understood that they were being examined. There's one which the prisoner drew of Kinsey looking at them and they're like, you know, looking back at him. So, yes. They understood that they were being studied, and for whatever reason, they still created objects like this.
Is anybody studying prisoners and sexuality today so that they're still accessing and collecting these materials?
Not as far as I know. This was a very discreet set from the 1940s through the 1960s. As far as I know, they're not confiscating and seizing and collecting materials like they were. So it's a capsule of time of what prisoners.
So we have no idea if the same things are going on or not.
No, we don't.
There's a quote from your book, page 161. Prison pornography documents a refusal to check the self. Instead of a sexuality regulated by social demands, these materials document the pleasures gained from a rejection of social control. And I think that's a really accurate description of these materials.
Yeah. You know, there are pamphlets about incest. There are pamphlets about rape. There's pamphlets about interracial rape. I mean, just things that people might check in other circumstance. There's no reason for people not to explore them to their fullest in this context. People wanted to see inside prisoners' minds, and prisoners let them.
Now, I want to follow along in the later parts of your book. And talk about from like the 1940s to the 1970s. This is a time period where sexual material is becoming more widely available, like in other words, commercially produced sexual material, especially when you get to the 50s and the 60s. Are people still making homemade pornography?
Yes. You would assume that the saturation would mean satiation, and it doesn't. People respond by making more and more of their own.
Although I have to say, when I look at your examples in the book, a lot of it sort of seems to just be like sort of fun, sort of funny stuff a lot, not all of it. But there's a lot of joking around going on, like the aprons with the penis and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Santa Claus, it just sort of seems to be sort of crude, like lewd folk art. That's what it is.
Right. Well, that might have to do with our definition of what pornography is.
Yep.
As much as what the materials themselves are. Like, we believe currently in the United States right now that pornography is very plasticized, it's very serious, it's very involved in, direct forms of intercourse. I don't know how to say it. But these materials show that there's a lot more that it can be.
And they have a wider audience, as you mentioned in the book. Women, gays, trans, African Americans, all of these people are now as in the imagery that you see in these objects.
Yes, and they're making it too.
That's it's right. And so that's a huge difference right there, because it was all mostly white males before.
Well, we don't know who it was before.
Okay.
That's the thing. There is no provenance, so we don't know who was making earlier forms of pornography. But once we start to have provenance, we can say definitively, wait, women were making this. Trans people were making this. African Americans were making this. So it demonstrates that, you know, this is a wide range of people creating their own visions of sexuality.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight returning is Lisa Z. Segal. She's a professor of history at DePaul University of Chicago. We're continuing our conversation about her new book, The People's Porn, A History of Handmade Pornography in America. What's trench art?
Trench art, it's a term given to World War I handmade objects. People would collect bones and shells and, clipboards, whatever sort of materials would show up in the trenches, and they would remake it into art forms.
And a lot of people don't realize this, but obviously pinups were very popular during World War II, mm-hmm. especially on plane fuselages. Did anybody collect those? Or there's no easy way to collect those, but there's photography of them. And a lot of them are a lot more, I guess, graphic than most people realize. They're not just, sort of Betty Page kind pinups.
Yes. And that's part of what happens is we have a very attenuated vision of what sexuality looked like in the past. If you start looking at all of the pinups from World War II, you'd be like, oh, wait, some of these are really explicit.
I know. I was surprised. I know. I was under the same assumption myself.
Yeah. If you look online, there's some really great collections of people collecting all of the different photographs that they have. And you're like, wow, those are not just.
No.
No. Yeah.
And I have to mention this because I'm fascinated by comics. You have to talk about eight pagers, Tijuana Bibles.
Okay. Tijuana Bibles were a popular form of pornography. They would remake popular characters often into a pornographic form.
Like and people in the news like Dillinger and stuff like that appeared in them.
Yes, but also things like Donald Duck. And Maggie and Jiggs, who were popular cartoon characters. So they would make short eight-page forms that would be easily pressed out and then stapled together.
And they're huge collector's items now. And this brings up another issue that you talk about at the end of the book, is what happens when these objects become object d'art and people start collecting them? It sort of changes everything.
It really does. And it depends if they become collector objects for people with erotic collections or art collections. If it goes into the bucket of erotic collections, you can get them fairly cheaply. They're not that expensive. If it becomes art, like Henry Dauger's, they are extraordinarily expensive.
But it also changes the whole aura of the object.
Yes. It's considered art and authentic, that it speaks to some sort of truth about humanity that goes beyond sexuality. If it becomes an erotic object, it's to be a connoisseur of erotica doesn't mean the same thing as to be a connoisseur of art. Let's just put it that way.
But how do you feel? How do you think about that? I mean, that sort of seems artificial and disingenuous to me.
To me too.
You say, I have a quote from you that I'm going to start writing on paper. Capitalism consumes authenticity and the making still matters.
Yes.
Expand on that.
People make pornography because the process of making things really matters to them. They want to go and create. They want to stamp the world with their own vision. Capitalism lately has all been about authenticity. So capitalism is selling the authentic, the true, the real, right, left, and sideways. And that's part of the reason why amateur porn is so popular right now. Because somehow it's supposed to be more real than regular porn. It's supposed to be authentic.
That's weird. And the thing is, we now know certain artists by name, people like Stephen Ashby.
Mm-hmm.
Are these people creating objects for the same reason that the folk art was created, or are they creating folk porn for the art industry?
Well, Stephen Ashby, he was creating objects because he was an artist.
Okay.
His erotica, he started making erotic objects, or they started appearing only after his wife died, and he would put them he would hide them, and then when collectors started coming to his house looking for objects, he began to take these out, and people would buy them. So he was creating lots and lots of objects that were all over his yard, all over his property. So for him, I think that he understood that these were erotic in some way, that he couldn't have them out on display, but I think it was part of a whole panoply of art that he created.
During the 50s and the 60s, a lot of homemade porn was important for gay communities too. And you have some fascinating examples in your book of these TypeScript stories. Can you talk about how these things were made?
I'm sighing because I'm like, there are people who work on queer sexuality who are masters of the TypeScript. And I feel like...
What do you mean masters of the... Do you mean they make it themselves?
Well, they make it themselves, or that they study these, that they know every little nuance. So I am sure I'm going to get something wrong, and someone's going to be like, no, this
okay.
is not...
We'll do an interview with them if they contact me.
Okay, yes, do an interview with them. So people would sometimes... use magazine collections and take those and then articulate stories around them. And one of the TypeScripts that I have in the book, it includes both. Other people would create stories and they would type them up and then do mimeograph copies and then sell those or circulate them in the gay community to provide a story basis for queer sexuality.
Now, these weren't reproduced. They were just circulated, correct? So they could make one copy of it and it would be circulated around?
Well, some of them were one copy. Some of them had mimeographs or what is it called when you do a carbon copy? So you might have one carbon.
That's right. There's examples of it in your book. I find it hard to believe that there's carbon copied porn. It just sounds so bizarre.
Yeah, well, before you had Xeroxing, there was carbon copies. People would go and type things up and then circulate it in the carbon form.
Now, are there regions in the country where people seem to be doing more of this than other regions? Like, is it the Northeast is doing it more than the South, or the West is doing it more than the Midwest, or what?
Well, there are regions where it has been collected better. I think that probably all different regions created their own erotic arts, but... Kinsey's place as a collector meant that things would congregate there. The West Coast, I'm sure materials were being created, but the collections I don't think are as extant, especially from the 19th century. Starting in the 20th century, I think that you start having more collections. But there's a predominance of East Coast and Midwest objects.
And that's not to say that they weren't created in the West.
No. I suspect that cowboys created their own porn, and I just haven't seen it. And, you know, one of the great things about this project is every time I give a talk, someone comes up to me and says, have you ever seen, and then they'll describe something, and I've never even heard of it. I'm like, oh, my God, really? Tell me more.
Well, is there a place to send objects or to alert people to where objects are? I mean, is there essentially a Kinsey for today where there's some institution that's collecting these objects?
There's a couple of institutions.
So there's like, is this reflective of the state of the art of sexuality research right now?
There is no state of, I mean, there's lots of people who work on the study of sexuality, but there is no funding for the study of sexuality. There are no fabulous grants to get. There's nothing like that. So people do it on their own dime, and they are labors of love, honestly.
Wow. Wow. So we still have, it's almost like we have less of a clue than we did back in the 50s with Kinsey.
Yes. Kinsey had Rockefeller. And I think that was one of the great granting agencies for the study of sexuality. Since then, ever since the year of the Mapplethorpe exhibit, funding has been getting cut systematically.
Okay. If I have to ask you, what's your favorite object that's in this book? What would it be? It can be from an academic point of view or just an enjoyment point of view. I'll tell you mine too.
Well, I love the scrimshaw because I love the idea that that Moby Dick, that there's this hidden side of Moby Dick. But I also love that little monkey figure that's made out of a peach pit. And then there is a illustration of prison porn. And it's just a pencil line drawing of this guy looking really goofy. It's one of the worst drawings, but it's a guy who's naked. And I'm like, for me, this is what homemade and handmade pornography looks like. It's kind of vulnerable and sad.
I like the fishing lure.
The fishing lure is fabulous.
It is pretty hilarious. And it would be great to catch something with it.
Oh, God. Could you imagine trying to get that out?
I know. Be that as it may, you'll have to get the book to see what we're talking about. My guest tonight has been Lisa Z. Siegel, professor of history at DePaul University, Chicago. And we've been talking about a new book, which is really fascinating. And as you can see, there's still so much that we don't know about the history of sexuality and people. The People's Porn, A History of Handmade Pornography in America. Lisa, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.